Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 17th of May, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson. Myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're also joined by David Scott. David, of course, from reporting from north of the border with Northern Exposure. I saw some news headlines this morning, Mike, and one of them was suggesting that Boris Johnson could become Prime Minister.
Yeah, we're going to start off with a little bit of comedy here, but, well, we should mention, of course, that Theresa May and Mr. Corbyn's negotiations have failed, so that's going nowhere, as expected. But the leadership contest seems to be on now, because the 1922 committee has told Theresa May that she basically has to go.
So we elect parties, we elect politicians, we really elect a prime minister in a way, but this mysterious committee simply decides when they're going to be culled.
Well, yes, but of course the British system is to not elect a prime minister. That's the point. But anyway, I just wanted to start off with this piece of pure, I presume it's satire. I can't imagine that the Telegraph is doing anything other than a satirical piece here. But the headline is "In Truss We Trust." Why I'm backing Liz for leader. And of course, this is Liz Truss, who, David Scott, I welcome you to the programme at this point, to me seems like possibly the most empty-headed member of the parliament that we have going. She's currently, I believe, Secretary to the Treasury, perfect for that job. Maybe under those circumstances, she would also be perfect as leader, but absolutely incredible that the Telegraph is suggesting that Liz Truss should be leader of the Tory party.
The most empty-headed member of parliament? Come on, Mike. This is a radical claim. There are dozens of excellent candidates for that particular post.
Can I just say that I think she could be in with a chance, because, of course, she's photographed here in the famous red dress, which, I mean, she's bursting out with enthusiasm, but normally it's the red dress that signifies you've been selected for the power play.
Yeah, but the problem is, you see, that Priti Patel's also wearing, well, in one photograph, a red dress there. Mm. So Priti has launched her Priti 4pm Twitter feed. So she's got a second Twitter feed now. She's only got 845 followers so far, but I guess that's not bad, because it was only launched in April 2019. So she's clearly been preparing for this. I don't really know what else to say other than if we think that the Brexit shenanigans have been ridiculous, I think the next few months are going to get even worse.
Yes, and viewers from overseas, of course, should realise that whoever it is that becomes British Prime Minister, they will be standing on a world stage and lecturing other countries and other national leaders as to how they should conduct affairs not only in their own countries, but, of course, worldwide, because Britain is clearly ruling the world still.
So let's move on to some slightly more serious issues. And well, this is the Oxford Research Group. Their headline in this article is "The Spotlight is on UK Special Forces, whether the government likes it or not." And they say allegations that UK Special Forces were assisting Saudi-backed militias in Yemen led to a short-lived public and parliamentary backlash. However, the government should not be too quick to forget this backlash or the lessons it offers. So they're pointing out that in March, the Daily Mail it published a report stating that five Special Boat Service soldiers had been wounded in a gun battle in Yemen. They make the point that this was very quickly, although it was reported in the Mail and covered by other newspapers, was very quickly forgotten about, brushed under the carpet. They said it remains unclear how many of these allegations were true and how they appear to have been mostly forgotten, and now they appear to be mostly forgotten by the UK media. However, it's worth dwelling on the lessons a little longer, and particularly the serious questions they raise around the UK's policy of blanket opacity over its use of special forces. It makes strategic sense, of course, they say, that certain information about special forces is not released to the public, as they are, by definition, units that operate covertly. However, in an era dominated by smartphones and burgeoning access to the internet, a policy which completely prevents the government from participating in debates over an increasingly large part of the UK military activity abroad, debates that will happen with or without them, has proven to be outdated, unsustainable, and most importantly, counterproductive. and they suggest that there needs to be much more discussion. But you know, for me, the issue, Brian and David, is that the fact that the British Special Forces were taking part in operations in Yemen has not yet been properly discussed at all in the media or by the media. There's been no attempt to hold government to account on this question. You know, this is the forgotten war, really, aside from the fact that we are occasionally given some headlines which give some insight into the scale of the suffering of civilians in that country. The fact that we appear to be supporting Saudi with boots on the ground was never debated in Parliament. It just seems to have happened. And of course, as we mentioned on this programme before, there is a blanket D-notice on discussing military activities. It certainly seems to me that it covers the activities of special services. But there is a serious question raised about whether these activities should be as opaque as they are.
Mike, unbelievably serious, all those things apply. But the other thing we've got to remember is that we've seen in the diagrams that special forces come under the empire of Mark Sedwell, who is controlling intelligence matters. He's controlling the budget. He's even auditing his own budget. So it's worse than the government is deploying special forces. We now have one individual that we can see who is responsible for the deployment of special forces, but there's other key people. We don't even know the names of the people who are putting these special forces into theatre. So what have we got running? We've got a mercenary army which appears to be controlled at the heart of unknown people within the Cabinet Office and under Mark Sedwell's empire. This should be something that we have every mainstream source in UK clamouring for information and carrying out proper investigatory journalism.
David, the article seems to be mainly concerned about the fact that this opacity may undermine the UK's ability to justify its relationship with Saudi Arabia, which would potentially stoke greater mistrust and concern. Bearing in mind what we appear to be doing in Yemen and our involvement in Yemen, is concern over mistrust or of the government, is that really supposed to be our top priority?
Oh, no, indeed. And we're way beyond opacity. We're in full cover-up. We're in believe these completely ridiculous things, right, because we're told to. The Express from February 17th this year, SAS soldiers on aid mission injured in roadside bombing. Two British Special Forces soldiers deployed on a top secret humanitarian mission in Yemen have been injured in a roadside. Yeah, you're laughing. You should. I mean, this is ridiculous. Have been injured in a roadside bomb blast. The soldiers, members of the elite SAS regiment, were part of a joint US-UK mission to identify areas in which supplies can be dropped to starving refugees. We are meant to believe this?
Yeah, David, I don't laugh at the fact those men were injured, and I'm quite sure they were injured. I laugh at the pack of lies around what their mission really was, because it's quite clear that the only time that Britain is providing aid to these troubled conflict zones, war zones overseas, is when they can use that aid as a further lever to get the British power in there. So my laugh was a very cynical laugh on that basis.
Well, look, here is HMS Queen Elizabeth, our illustrious aircraft carrier, which seems to be a bit tarnished today because it has lost its captain. So here he is. This is Commodore Nick Cook-Priest. He's no longer captain of the aircraft carrier because apparently, Brian, he has been a very naughty boy and he's decided to be using the official car to drive home at the weekends. Well, as a result, the Royal Navy spokesman has been quoted widely in the press as saying, "We can confirm Captain Nick Cook-Priest has been reassigned to a new role. We can only say that management action is ongoing, and it would therefore be inappropriate to comment further." Now, he apparently was using the Ford Galaxy for personal journeys. A former officer said to The Sun that Nick adores the Navy and has lost his career by doing what captains have done for decades, using the company car to get home. An innocent mistake has cost the Navy one of its best. I have to say, I'm highly sceptical about this, because really, is that a reason to sack somebody who is the captain of your flagship on the basis of him misusing government property to get home? Or, and this is pure speculation, was he perhaps uncomfortable with the aircraft that he was likely to have to, that he's been taking on board in recent weeks and months?
We've got to ask some questions on this one, Mike, because this is absolutely ridiculous to suggest this. The cars provided for the captain's use are there for that use. If he was to use it to go home, the worst that I could imagine the Navy would have said is, you need to pay us the petrol money, but the car is there for his use. And if the state can't manage to pay petrol for a captain of this importance and seniority, I know he's a Commodore, but his role is captain of the ship, then something very strange is going on. So we've been right on our analysis in the past. We smell a rat on this one. We think that he's been sacked because of something he said about the operational performance of the carrier, or as Mike has suggested, the F-35. We'll stand by that and we'll see how it develops. What came into my mind as you reported, Mike, was the policeman Mike Veal, who investigated Ted Heath for abuse. He was fitted up over the fact he damaged a police mobile phone. And I felt that this was about on par.
Okay, well, yesterday we put out a little video on Twitter, and this was from the 9th of May this year at Camp Butmir in Sarajevo. Well, it was International EU Day. And as you can see, they were having a nice little medal ceremony. And there we have all the member states' flags, all the people taking part on EU4 in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And there's the UK flag under the UK flag under the EU flag there. So that seems to me that the message that's being delivered is that it's subservient.
Correct.
Right. So the video went on because there is the EU medal. There's the EU4 medal with the EU stars on it. And the question we asked on Twitter yesterday was how many British troops received EU4 medals. Now, we don't know exactly what the number is, but Major Andrew Fox decided to weigh into the discussion because he's very proud of his Althea medal. He received it at Camp Butmir. There it is. So I have to admit, when he got involved in the conversation, I thought I recognised him. And then I realised that, in fact, he'd...
He was the man.
He was the man. He had walked down the steps, as we showed on this programme several months ago, off the plane, proudly wearing the EU insignia on his arm. And so we sort of asked about this, and this was his response. This is literally me in the photo, so I suggest I know what I'm talking about. And he was suggesting that he was under NATO command. But this is an EU4 operation, which is an EU operation. We'll come on to that in a second. But in the course of the discussion, he went on to say this. Essentially, this was just on arrival to keep it simple for the media so that there was one brand. Every other day of the tour, we wore the badge of the multinational battalion of which we were a part. We were picked as the main company for every mission and did the UK proud. So that was his position. They only wore the EU flag on the day that the video was taken, and the rest of the time they didn't wear it. As the conversation went on, then he confirmed that by posting this photograph with the other badges. And there's the EU4 badge that they apparently wore, and also the other badge that they wore. And he said, you may rest easy, my friend. We only wore the EU flag one as it's all they had enough for a whole company. So in other words, he's saying that...
they had a limited number in stock.
Well, exactly. Is that credible?
I don't think so, where the EU's concerned, because we know money for EU publicity is unlimited. Leaflets, videos, promotional conferences are awash with money, but they didn't have enough badges. I'm not sure we buy that one, really.
Right, OK. Well, he went on to say, as soon as we got there, we switched to the one on the left and then to the one on the right. So that's quite interesting because the EU4 badge there has the EU4 logo on it and a Union flag on it. I thought that was quite interesting because in the video itself, no other country seems to have a country logo, a flag on the EU4 badge. Yeah. So perhaps there's a bit of doth protest too much. But just to get back to the NATO point, I just want to remind everybody of the EU Defence Union diagram that they have published, that the European Commission has published. And what they say quite clearly in the documentation that goes alongside this diagram is that each pillar that's in the diagram is a key pillar for defence union, and you cannot have defence union unless all pillars are in place. On the right-hand side there, one of the core partnerships is with NATO, and we've played video on this programme many times showing Jens Stoltenberg saying how close, and also Federica Mogherini saying how close the relationship between NATO and the EU is. So that's a key partnership. David, I was wondering what your thoughts are on this, because the thing that fascinated me about the conversation on Twitter was that the suggestion that the badge was taken off after a day and replaced with something else. Now, if you remember back a couple of months ago, Andrew Bridgen, MP, was speaking at the Bruges Group, and he had raised a parliamentary question about the fact that UK troops were wearing EU flags. And he said in his presentation at the Bruges Group that as soon as he had asked that question, he had received an assurance from the Ministry of Defence that the badges had been removed. And that seems to tie up with what our major says. But at the time, UK Defence Journal was reporting statements from both Permanent Joint Headquarters and the Ministry of Defence saying that the badges had not been removed. So there seems to be some questions to be asked still about this. And I frankly don't buy this notion that that the UK wears EU flags getting off a plane so as to not to confuse the branding for the media.
Yes, it's bizarre to be using, again, business management terms. When the captain was dismissed from the aircraft carrier, we were having management action. This is business world speak. We're talking about defining the brand. Why are we defining the brand of the EU as a provider of military intervention and might? Why would we be doing that? Right. There's only one reason that we're building up that brand, because we plan to make that the defining characteristic and the lead idea in the future. That's the only rational business explanation for that. You're building up the brand because you want to exploit it later on.
We could also add to that that, of course, we see that everything we used to regard as civil service and public sector is now being commercialized, so that we have immense power from the big globalist companies to back up this branding and management speak.
Yes, the idea that we're using management speak, we're using ideas from the commercial world solely. There's something else happening, that the language and ideas and concepts that underpin the idea of public service, they're dying, they're disappearing, and we're left with only one approach. It's very strange.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, while all of that is going on, was intrigued to pick up this article from Plymouth Live. So, at face value, this is a small report from a local Plymouth news outlet, Plymouth Live. Well, what are they talking about? They're talking about the Spanish Navy pulling one of its warships from a US Navy combat fleet on an unscheduled mission to respond to what the White House has called escalatory indications and warnings from Iran. The Spanish frigate left the USS Abraham Lincoln strike group as it entered the Persian Gulf at the time of, quote, heightened tensions between Washington and Tehran. Now, I can't find this reported in any other easy UK mainstream media. Reuters has mentioned it. No other comment from any of the big defence journalists, not from The Telegraph or The Times, can't see it in The Guardian. But this is very significant that obviously the Spanish don't put any credence to these US claims of actions by Iran. And they said, no, we're not having our warship continue to stay with that group. This was actually the quote from Maria Margarita Robles, who's the Spanish judge, who's now Spanish defense minister. She said this: Spain has never given its blessing for the frigate to go on a mission in the Persian Gulf, and that it will return to the US fleet once scheduled operations resume. The decision to remove a frigate on training exercises with the US was taken purely as, quote, technical reasons, and was not an expression of distaste over the crossing into the Strait of Hormuz by the fleet headed by the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier. The decision was, quote, prudent and perfectly admissible under the terms of a two-year cooperation agreement that placed the Nunez frigate with the US fleet for advanced training. There's a lot of very weaselly words there, but the root for this is that the Spanish obviously decided they didn't want to get engaged with the latest US claims. But we need to say, where is the US evidence for these escalatory indications? Because we have never seen any evidence to back up the rhetoric, which of course has been followed through by the UK.
Mm. Let's move on to censorship and so on. And I want to say I'm more impressed by Chelsea Manning as time goes on, because this person is absolutely determined not to be bullied by the United States government and the full weight of the United States government. So Chelsea Manning is back in prison again because she's refused to testify before another grand jury. So she said she'd rather starve to death than cooperate, and said, told the judge that in Alexandria in Virginia, as I say, that she'd rather starve to death. So having served 62 days in prison already, and 28 of those were in solitary confinement, she's now looking at 18 months more. And what's more, if she continues to refuse to give the testimony to the grand jury and is still in prison after 30 days, she's going to be fined $500 per day from that point onwards. And if she gets 60 days in prison, it's going to go up to $1,000 a day. So the US establishment absolutely determined to bully Chelsea Manning. And of course, what's this about? Probably Julian Assange, but actually nobody knows that for sure, because this grand jury is happening in secret. So David, this is quite an incredible situation, in my opinion, that somebody is being persecuted in this way. And really, what discussion about it is there in the mainstream press? What outrage is there in the public?
Oh, none. And the remarkable thing is not that someone is being persecuted in this way, because this is now standard operating procedure. The remarkable thing, and we must, you're right to highlight it, we must make a major issue about this. The remarkable thing is she's resisting. Right, the number of people who will take this degree of pressure and not buckle is tiny. This is how the state operates, and it operates in this way because it's normally completely effective. And it's only people who have made the decision that I'm drawing the line and I will not move. And they're very few, and they need our support.
Absolutely couldn't agree more. Now, coming back to the UK then, obviously we mentioned a couple of weeks or a few weeks ago the online harms white paper, which the British government had released. Free speech, we said, was complete shutdown, and indeed it was. One of the harms that they wanted to deal with is online disinformation. Another one, online manipulation of people's opinions. Jeremy Wright was giving a speech yesterday to a tech forum in Paris. And he said that he's proud of the work that the British government has done in the UK to strike a balance between how we're going to protect people online and how we will protect online freedoms. Of course, they're not doing the second one at all, and they're not doing the first one either. In fact, what they're doing is shutting down free speech, as we've demonstrated. Now, just to remind everybody that there is a consultation in progress. It's a 3-month consultation in total, so we're probably about halfway through that at the moment. So there is a consultation for people, any member of the public that wants to give their views on, to get involved in, and I absolutely encourage everybody to do that. So if you search online for online harms consultation, you'll get there. But Jeremy Wright went on to say this, the theme for France's presidency of the G7 is building digital trust together. And so I'm pleased that this week we've joined with other G7 member states to reaffirm our commitment to defending the founding principles of the internet. Now, I would like somebody to provide me with a set of the founding principles of the internet, because I've been involved with the internet since about 1994, and I don't remember there being any founding principles of the internet. So this is an attempt to rewrite history. If I'm wrong, I'm happy to be wrong, and I'll correct that on this program if somebody could provide me with them. But what we have here now is the G7 getting involved in following Britain's lead with respect to the shutdown of free speech on the internet. And I just want to remind everybody that this isn't the first time that the G7 has done this, because if we go back to 2017, G7 meeting, Theresa May organised for all the G7 leaders to sign up to a new rapid response mechanism, which was, amongst other things, all about controlling a narrative, in the sense that attribution of blame for any particular event that they felt needed attribution of blame to be made would be given a common attribution of blame across all the G7 nations. She went on to say, today's announcement shows that we're getting organised, and we will take coordinated action against those who seek to violate the rules-based international system. So there you have it. That's what it's all about. Jeremy right now reinforcing that with the G7. We should be absolutely comfortable with that, shouldn't we?
Well, yeah, I think we could just go home and watch TV while these people defend our interests. Or maybe not.
But it gets better. It gets better. And David, I'm looking forward to hear what your views on this. But if anybody was worried about what happened in Salisbury last year, you don't need to worry about it, because the BBC is going to produce a 2-part drama to dramatise the Salisbury Novichok poisoning. Because if you were in doubt about the narrative with respect to Salisbury, that's about to be corrected. So it's currently an untitled drama. It's going to tell the story of, quote, how ordinary people reacted to a crisis on their doorstep, displaying extraordinary heroism. Now, what's very interesting about this is that they say that the BBC has commissioned a 2-part drama inspired by the 2018 Novichok poisoning in Salisbury. Well, David, what can we say about that?
I'm looking forward to this enormously. Now, the way I saw this panning out is that Brian Gerrish gets a bit part in this, and he plays an itinerant baby wipe salesman and is the unsung hero of the entire event.
Well, that may be the case. I'm hoping that's the case. I haven't heard whether Brian's got himself an agent for that yet. But I do believe that the former chief medical officer will be playing herself. So hopefully okay. that's just a rumour at this point, but it has been passed to me, so we shall see.
And in case there's any misunderstanding, we would consider any of the local Salisbury residents who used baby wipes to clean military-grade nerve agent Novichok using baby wipes. I think they would have been pretty heroic. We're lost for words now, aren't
yes,
we?
Yes, go, because David.
No, just one further question. Does this involve a laughter track?
Haven't. No. My understanding is that they will do this in the style of MASH with no laughter track.
Okay. But we will provide our own laughter, I'm sure. This is going to be just wonderful.
Yes. Okay, well, let's get back to serious subjects again, David. And, Celtic Boys Club.
Celtic Boys Club, the first few slides here were actually ones which we ran back in October, you see from the poppy and the heading there. And this was looking at the case then, and it's moved on a little bit, and it's worth just revisiting this, because the social pressure and social media, and to be fair, some of the mainstream media, again, not the BBC, but papers like the Daily Record in Glasgow, are actually moving this story on and continuing to campaign for the victims of abuse, even though there is no sort of official recompense so far for them. Now,
David, just to remind everybody, this is a sort of junior football club linked but not directly owned by Celtic Football Club in Scotland. Is that right?
That's it. It was called the Celtic Boys Club. It's been rebranded and it's called something else now. But it was called the Celtic Boys Club, and it was set up with the approval of Celtic Football Club in 1966. It was very successful in footballing terms. They won the European Junior Cup in 1974, and it's been a nursery for a great many professional players. So a very successful club. Trains at Barrowfield, Celtic's ground, training facility. Wears the Celtic strip and shares the branding. Now, Celtic, when this abuse came to light, Celtic said the following, following the conviction of Mr. James Torbert, Celtic Football Club wishes to express our deep regret for the incidents which took place and sympathy for the victims who suffered abuse. When the allegations became known in the 1990s, Celtic Football Club took steps to develop a new code of conduct and procedures to protect young people. Now, remember, the founder of this in 1966 has been convicted. So there was decades of abuse before the 1990s, before anything was done. Moving forward in this, coming up to sort of more recent, we'll just quickly run through the next slide here. This is the sort of press coverage that was that actually brought this to the fore, right? So the victim spoke to the Daily Record. The Daily Record campaigned on their behalf. This is how it came out. It wasn't done through the police. It wasn't done through the club. It wasn't done through local authorities and social workers. It was done through the public and the press.
Asking there, would this happen today? And I think the answer is probably no.
Well, perhaps not, but certainly the Daily Record is still campaigning at the moment. So the next slide here was announcing that legal action has been taken. So this is ongoing. So there's legal action against Celtic Football Club. And the dynamic of this is that Celtic Football Club is saying, no, the Boys Club is a separate entity and it's nothing to do with us legally. We're very sorry and all that, and we'll give you sympathy, but there'll be no compensation. So that's the Celtic Football Club position. And this is the position that's now coming apart. When we reported this before, we talked briefly about the SFA. The SFA were saying, we believe that the abuse is in the past and that everything's fine now. And we did highlight the official inquiry run by Martin Henry. And Martin Henry said, do I believe that currently people in football are safe? Yes, pretty much. So there we go. That was reassuring. We were pretty much safe. And we did point out at the time that Martin Henry was a founder of LGBT Youth Scotland with Jamie Rennie. And he was on the board, and Jamie Rennie was chief executive, and Jamie Rennie was a paedophile who perpetrated the most horrendous abuse on children and was convicted despite being a member of Common Purpose and Common Purpose trained. So that's background.
He was a bit more than that, David, because of course he was part of their. Wasn't he part of their?
No, you're thinking of the other one.
Oh, right. Okay.
James
okay.
Rennie was just Common Purpose trained, but you haven't mentioned it. So I'll mention it. In the gang that he was part of, they were abusing children with ages of months. So
yes.
This is pretty disgusting. And as far as we know, Common Purpose never carried out any form of internal investigation to see if there were other child abusers that had managed to creep into Common Purpose's secretive networks.
So the official inquiry has been run by a former associate of this man, but football's pretty much safe. So that was the position. It's now coming under attack and it's now coming apart. So the Daily Record has reported that the Celtic FC carried out an inquiry back in 1986 and cleared all of the people over these, quote, scurrilous abuse claims. So in 1986, Celtic Football Club Board was looking into this, and they were saying there's nothing to see here, despite the former head of Celtic Boys Club going public in the press and saying there was abuse going on. The Celtic board said, no, 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 it's all a lie. It's scurrilous rumours. There's nothing to see here. Now, the next photograph is just astonishing. This is in the Daily Record today, right? So this is, you see this, the boys of Celtic Boys Club, and they're celebrating the win. I'm not sure if this is the 1974 European Cup win, but it could well be. So they're celebrating, and there's the adults that are looking after this boys club, and the three ring there have all been convicted of paedophilia, have all been convicted of abusing the children within the care. Now look at the children, is that not what a paedophile ring looks like? This is grooming on a huge scale, and the man in the foreground was the kit man, so he was also involved. So you've got a level of abuse that is institutional. I spoke this week to someone who had a trial for Celtic Boys Club at this point, and he turned up beautifully, naively, in his Rangers kit to have the trial for Celtic Boys Club. And he was told that he probably wasn't the sort of lad he was looking for, though he was a very good footballer. And he didn't go and get a position in the club. But one of his friends did. And that friend was abused, and that friend's in a terrible state now to this day. And the abuse was horrendous, and the abuse was everywhere. And Celtic knew, and this is the thing, they were investigating in 86 and saying nothing's to be seen here, but Celtic knew. And the abusers were actually all eliminated. They were sort of, they were removed from position under the time when Jock Stein was running Celtic. And they were brought back. So there was two periods of abuse. There was an early period, then all the abusers were removed, and then they came back into the club, and the abuse then carried on once again. So there are many questions for Celtic to answer. So this goes on, and if you look at next, the BBC here are reporting, the BBC report after the people are convicted, the BBC will report on it. Up until that point, they're pretty well silent. They're not the people doing the campaigning that's bringing this to light. But they will report on the convictions. So here you see Frank Kearney, guilty of abuse. Jim McCafferty, who preyed on the dreams of football stardom. And you've got the next slide here, Gerald King, ex-Celtic Boys Club, spared jail despite being found guilty of abuse. And Jim Torbett, the founder of the Celtic Boys Club, guilty of abusing boys. So it's all now being proved in court. Celtic Boys Club has had, say, in football in terms, a very illustrious career. The if you look on Wikipedia, there's a list of the footballers who have come through that club. This list here includes Alan Brazil, who's gone public and the abuse that he suffered as a young boy in football. There's also Charlie Nicholas, David Moyes, Tommy Burns, who was the Celtic manager when these abusers came back into the club. All very strange. Now, we've then got the extract from the Celtic newspaper, the Celtic View, that is listing the investigation and how they conclude. This is the investigation into the allegations of abuse back in 1986. They conclude those boys' club leaders who have been placed under a cloud as a result of these rumours have instructed their lawyers to take appropriate course of action, and if necessary, to go to a court of law to make sure these scurrilous stories are buried once and for all. An interesting choice of word. I think that's what you call an embedded confession. So we are now... this is reporting in the Record again. Patrick Maguire of Thompson's Solicitors. He's representing a lot of the abuse victims. And he said to the Record, the former directors of Celtic have got to be clear about what they thought they were investigating back in the mid-80s. The survivors might team represent deserve answers from the club about these investigations, and they continue to be shocked and insulted that the board maintain that the Boys Club and Celtic FC are separate organisations. The survivors must receive an official apology from the club and be properly compensated for the terrible things that happened to them when, as children, they were under Celtic's care. This is morally right and decent thing to do, but if Celtic continue to ignore us, as I said before, we will see them in court. And then I spoke to Patrick Maguire this morning about this, and he said Celtic need to stop hiding behind lawyers and set up a fund, as Manchester City has done, to negotiate directly with the victims and the representatives. So here you see Pat, he's pointed to Manchester City to issue an apology and set up fund for the Benal abuse victims. So it is possible for the football club to take responsibility and to make amends and to act appropriately rather than just hide behind lawyers. And I would say that the social media pressure is mounting. We've seen MSPs who support Celtic Football Club making kind of half-hearted damage limitation statements. James Dorman in the MSP. But we're seeing it's not working. Social media is full of comments on this. And the new nickname on social media for Celtic Football Club is Separate Entity FC. Mm.
Right. Well, as we often say to our viewers and listeners, we bring news together very late, just at the last moment before the programme. We don't pre-plan things. But while you've been working on that, I was actually working on this. A lot of people have been contacting the UK column to alert us to the fact that Private Eye is, well, what people are saying is muddying the waters over child abuse investigation. So there's material up on Private Eye. I have not listened to this particular podcast myself. I will do, because I think it's important that we hear what they're saying. But what is being reported into the UK column is people are getting a sense that Private Eye is working to muddy investigations into child abuse. And particularly we're alerted to this article, Satanic Panic Wedges Pitch. There is no doubt that this article is undermining really John Wedger, the policeman's testimony about what he observed and the cover-up of child abuse in London. And they do it very cynically by trying to mix it in with what they call satanic theory. So we have a police officer brave enough to stand up and report what happened to him when he tried to deal with child abuse and report it. And in comes Private Eye, muddying the water and really starting to chip away to undermine John Wedger. Now, I find this very offensive. We actually spoke to Private Eye this morning to try and establish the author and date of publication of the article. But the lady who was very, I don't know what I picked over the phone. I think she might have been nervous for some reason. She said, oh, well, we never disclose who the journalist is. That's always secret. My words. They said if we sent an email, they would attempt to give us some information. So we'll see what's happened. But I'd encourage people to have a look at what Private Eye is doing here, because I think we have cause for concern. This is another article which is muddying the waters by mixing what somebody has been saying about child abuse with what they've been saying about the BBC and reporting in Syria. And of course, if we're talking Private Eye, we need to bring this lady in, Rosie Waterhouse, Journo, Sunday Times, Independent on Sunday, Newsnight, a director of Masters in Investigative Journalism at City University. And on the April the 6th, she tweeted out here, happy to share all my questions to Anna, John Wedger and Michael Taraga. Where was Michael between 1952 and 1960 with wicked sex abusing foster parents, or in a children's home in London where he had many happy memories? Inconsistency unanswered. She's not getting out there to investigate the hundreds of children that are coming forward to talk about their abuse. She's simply digging a little knife into people who are reporting. And I think we need to take her up for this. Why does she not get out of her office, get onto the streets and start talking to the children who are, and adults, of course, now, who are clearly warning about the scale of this abuse? And I'll just end this segment by saying, if you've got any concerns over what Private Eye is doing here, this is the contact details for editorial at Private Eye. And of course, we always say, if you've got questions or you want to challenge an organisation like Private Eye, the more measured, the more polite you are, the more precise in your questions and comments, the more difficult it is for them to deal with it. But I smell a rat, David, on this one. Why would Private Eye want to, why would they want to muddy the water over child abuse?
Why indeed? Anyone who's familiar with the Range List might have a theory on that. Rosie Waterhouse was also one of the leading journalists attacking Robert Greene and Mike Veal and anything else that seems to be investigating satanic abuse. It does beg the question what exactly her motivation is in all of this.
Okay, well, look, we're right out of time, but we began the programme with a bit of comedy over the Tory leadership and the Tory leaders. Let's end the programme by moving north of the border, David, and the absolute comedy show, which is Nicola Sturgeon.
Oh, the SNP, have been hilarious this week. It's really been just non-stop laughter. Nicola Sturgeon went on local radio and announced that she suffers from imposter syndrome.
Now, I haven't heard of imposter syndrome before. You're going to have to define that one for me.
Well, I thought, well, I'll go to psychology today and get a proper assessment. It's a psychological phenomenon in which people are unable to internalize their accomplishments. Imposter syndrome is a term referring to a pattern of behavior where people doubt their accomplishments and have a persistent, often internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud. So there you go. That is Nicola's problem. And in the SNP, there are many other problems as there is a major war raging between different wings of the SNP over the definition of what it is to be a man and a woman. And yeah, this is becoming very bitter. It's called Turf War, and it's ongoing. So, yes, we'll watch this very, very carefully.
Well, maybe we'll have a little bit of a discussion about that in the extra time segment in a minute. I think we better
end there. But I'd just like to end on a very positive news note to say that we now know that Melanie Shaw is well. She is in Rampton Hospital, the first contact after many, many months says that at the moment she is in good hands. I can't say too much more because of a variety of reasons, but I know there's many people out there have been desperately worried about Melanie Shaw. So I'm going to say we are in contact, which of course is very, very good. And I hope this is going to lead on to even better reports. But something I can tell you is that Melanie will have spent 24 months in solitary confinement, often with just a mattress on the floor of her cell. And again, I keep pushing this for overseas viewers, particularly if you're watching from America, you're in Seattle or San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, or Florida, or any of the other overseas. This is the state of Britain under Theresa May's Conservative government, a government which says it can stand on the world stage and tell other countries how to behave. It's truly outrageous. Imposter syndrome, I think it's called. Yeah. David, thank you very much for that. We will be back at the same time on Monday.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.